Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 30th of October. Welcome to the program. I'm Joe Donahue. We have we're going to get to our roundtable panel, and for reasons that I am completely responsible for, we missed the opening billboard of telling you what's on the show because I was talking to the boss, and none of our clocks were synced. So I think I got 3 minutes. I didn't. Anyway, the 10th annual Brava event is happening. They provide new bras to those in need coming to Troy on Thursday, November 6th. Brava is an amazing event. And the founder or co-founder, Marion Roach Smith, has been doing this. It's 10 years now, and we'll talk to her and the team at the YWCA of the Greater Capital Region coming up later on. We'll also talk to mystery writer Riley Sager. He's written about a mystery set on a train. Stop me if you've heard this. And there's 8 people on the train, and a bunch of them end up dead. A closed room
Where
mystery.
Where is the train going?
It's going from Philadelphia to Chicago.
Okay.
Oh, so they all committed suicide rather than...
Well, I don't want to give anything away. No spoilers, Bob. I don't want to tell people
Chicago.
Where this is headed. But anyway, so we'll talk about that a little later on. All right, let's introduce the group to you. A communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore. Hello, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm good. I'm back. I was out Monday. I was out Wednesday. I had jury duty.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Jury duty.
Yeah.
Antibiotics fixed that?
Yes, it did. it absolutely did. And I won't get into it other than to say that it was it could have taken me out of commission for a really long time, and so I was rather happy that I would have gladly served, obviously, but it was nice that it didn't happen.
So did you get rejected? Did somebody voir-dire you out? Use one of their automatic exclusions ding you?
That's absolutely what happened. And for reasons I don't want to get into personally, they asked 3 questions. They said, "Did you this? Did you this? Did you this?" And I said yes to every one of them, and then. Boom. I was let go.
So it's like, did you ever smoke pot in college? Have you ever lived in a rent-regulated or rent-controlled apartment?
I mean, like, for example,
have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Or have you or a member of your family ever been the victim of a violent crime? And my wife was the victim of a violent crime.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Do you know about this case? Yeah. How do you know it? Because I work in the news. So
it used to be it was
like
very
that.
Hard for anybody in the news business to get on a jury for that
yes.
reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
They know too many cops. They know too many of the
Well, and they were more worried about a family member that I have that is an investigator and testifies and so forth. So I had a kind of a triple whammy. But
You see, notwithstanding those questions, you would be an ideal guy at a jury.
I've been on a jury. I've served on a jury twice. I loved it. I learned more about myself and my and humankind at that particular experience than I have in most pursuits of life.
No, 'cause you are extraordinarily curious.
I'm curious, and I really can be, because even the judge said to me, "Well, can you remain impartial?" And I said, "I can probably remain impartial,
probably.
But I still, but I'm meaning I know what I know, right?
Right.
You can't take that away." Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm back. It's really nice to be back. Thank you very much.
Welcome back.
Thanks to the court system. By the way, I just real quick, they don't need me to say this, but I was at the federal court and I just was impressed by how amazing that machine worked. They get you in, they get you out, they talk to you, they treat you like human beings. They're all lovely. Everybody was nice. The people who were there genuinely seemed like they you know, I don't think anybody's like, ooh, pick me, but, you know, they're all there like, okay, I'll do what I have to do. And it was just a very nice experience, and I'm really glad I'm out of it. Okay.
Joe, I'm going to suggest that for your future segment, you interview yourself on your experience of the jury that you were not on.
Yeah. Well, am I interested in how this all works out? Absolutely. Of course I am. But we'll find that out. Communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore. Hello, Bob. How are you?
You just said that. And then you are now experiencing the amazing phenomena of deja vu.
I was not here, and I forgot how to do the job. By the way, not for nothing, today is my 30th anniversary at WAMC.
Woohoo!
Oh, my God.
Yeah, October 30th, 1995. Yeah.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond is with us. Hello, Bill. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm honored to be here on your 30th anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I brought that up because Bob was telling me it was deja vu, and I just want you to say that after 30 years, I still don't really know how to do this job.
But also, you have experienced literally everything before.
Former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick is with us. Judy Patrick, hello. Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. You know, the federal courts don't get covered like they used to. I mean, we never were really great at covering federal trials. And so I'd be interested to check out the papers and see what case this really was. You don't have to tell us, Joe.
I can't.
But federal courts, it's kind of a mystery sometimes what happens there. County courts get more coverage typically.
Well, it was, again, I just want to say it was a lovely experience. And if you're called to do it.
For most people.
Yeah. Well, we're right. If you're on the other side, not as great. You're absolutely right. Okay. Let's go to the news of the day. And we have lots to talk about. I was asked by my colleagues to make this short. I will. the Fed has trimmed rates again, but the future cuts remain uncertain. The central bank moved to steady the economy amid a weakening job market, even as inflation stays elevated and key data goes dark. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point on Wednesday for its second consecutive meeting, seeking to steady the economy amid a weakening labor market as a month-long government shutdown has clouded its view. Wednesday's widely expected move lowers the Fed's benchmark interest rate to a range of 3.75% to 4%, the lowest level in about 3 years. Fed policies influence what households and businesses pay for mortgages, credit cards, and other loans. Risks to employment rose in recent months, the Fed said in a statement. The decision, however, exposed divisions among policymakers over how much further the central bank should go in supporting growth, underscoring uncertainty about the path ahead. Chair Jerome Powell said in a news conference that the pressure of stubborn inflation and the weakening labor market stirred tension and disagreement among the 19 policymakers about what to do about interest rates in the months to come. That from The Washington Post. Who would like to start?
You know, the labor market is indeed weakening. I was reading a report yesterday about how it's especially in the manufacturing sector, you're seeing a real backpedaling of jobs, especially like in the semiconductor industry, which we thought was going to be the savior for us going forward. So it wasn't so long ago when businesses were shutting down on certain days because they couldn't get enough people to, you know, run their places. But now we're seeing a shutdown in the number of good, I think, you know, blue-collar jobs that are out there. I think it's in the auto parts manufacturing sector as well. Meanwhile, I think white-collar jobs are on the rise. You know, the cuts in these federal rates never really make sense to the average American who looks at their, you know, their MasterCard bill and they see that they have a 27% interest rate on whatever credit card balance they're carrying. So I know that it does affect how fast houses sell, how many cars people sell. So this is an important part of the economy. But, you know, the idea that they may not get a third rate cut in December has the market rattled. But, man, that market is easily rattled.
It's interesting to me. They're doing what Trump asked them to do, or at least in the same direction as what he wanted them to do. He wanted them to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy. Presidents often ask the Fed to do that kind of thing because they want the economy to be as stimulated as possible. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has gone to great lengths to try and assert independence, the independence of the Fed from the president. There was a famous scene where he was, you know, giving the president a tour of the building, and the president was saying something about the construction project. He said, "No, Mr. President, you're wrong." Like he's done the theater of showing independence, and in the end, they're giving the president part of what he wants. I think one of the subtexts of the story is the Fed is complaining or pointing out that they don't have all the data that they usually have when they make a decision like this, partly because of the furloughs. So all the federal workers who do the data collection and number crunching and reporting, some of them aren't at their desks. Another thing that was on my mind anyway is a lot of the data that they depend on comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where the president sort of famously fired the head of that because he didn't like one of their reports and put in somebody he thought would give him reports that he likes. After something like that happens, I feel like, you know, the level of trust that you give to the statistics coming out of that agency diminishes to some degree. I haven't seen any reporting of people saying, you know, this number looks wrong or this number looks like it was massaged. But I wonder if that's weighing on the Fed's mind as well.
Good point. Bob?
The only question on my mind is whether you believe or don't believe that monetary policy is restrictive or not. That's all I have to say. That's my one line. I read it, and that's what I'm saying, because that's about what I know about this, which I think mirrors where most people are on this. This is, you know, well, what would they say? I would give my kingdom for a one-armed economist.
Did they say that?
Yeah, it's like you got on the one hand, on the other
okay,
hand.
All right,
know.
I didn't know that was a thing. I missed that.
Joe, the story you read could essentially be a Mad Lib for any time the Fed – the Fed does anything. The Fed did fill in the blank. There is uncertainty about fill in the blank. People don't know what will happen next, whether they will go more in that direction or more in the other direction. People disagree on the impact and why they did it. And in the current environment, it took us four sentences to get to talk about Trump.
But in
which is a record slowness for this show.
The president of Burger King is now on CNN talking about that the price of beef has risen nearly 5%. So
seems like more than five, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But I'm not good at this.
It's more than five.
Okay, and to the point of, to your point, Bob, how does this, I think it comes down to how we feel individually, how it affects us, right?
No, I don't think it's, well, how we feel it affects us is one thing. How it actually affects us is another thing.
Well, right.
So, because we got a lot of things now generated on feelings and not facts and reality.
We saw that yesterday when Jerome Powell was talking. The market went down when he first started talking. But then as he continued to talk, the market started to feel better and it started to level off. It was the craziest
thing. Somebody in the back telling him to stretch. Keep going.
So
yeah,
I don't pretend to really understand any of this stuff. But I get the sense that there are certain jobs that the Fed does, setting those interest rates. And also it has some ability to figuratively print money. So like during the huge crisis in 2008 and 2009, they were able to pump a bunch of money into the system in a way that prevented banks from collapsing, which would have, you know, tanked the economy. So they have these powers. They are, and it's enormous, it's, these are important powers that have ramifications that sort of ripple out into the broader economy, and they are unelected. They're kind of a priesthood, right? They have to be really smart about the economy. They pay a lot of attention to the data. They have huge staffs that generate all kinds of analyses. But then ultimately, it's a vote of however many people sit on the board. And each one of those people is going to have a different opinion. They had some dissent from yesterday's meeting, especially from one of the new presidential appointees who wanted there to be more aggressive action to stimulate the economy. But the thing is that you want to know that there's a steady hand on that tiller, they can't turn on a dime, they can't determine the fate of the economy, but they can play this role, and you want to know that it's a steady hand that's thinking about the long term and also the greater interest of the country. And that's sort of what Jerome Powell's job is, to kind of sell that to the public. That's who we are. That's what we're doing. We're being steady. And we are trying, and we're building trust in the economy, because the economy depends a lot on trust and perception.
Well, there are so many things besides this benchmark interest rate that influence jobs.
Yes.
I mean, you want to talk about the decline in manufacturing jobs. Say hello to AI, right, and automation. And all these jobs in these manufacturing jobs that are now being automated, or things that can be done by AI that are, you know, that are, tend to or have the potential to eliminate lots of jobs that people would do. So, you know, there are, you know, jobs, inflation are the result of so many different factors. And people make, it is a huge mistake to try to say, well, it's, you know, to isolate it to, it's this thing. So, you know, it's in the mix. And Bill, I want to say, I think we failed. You wanted to make this fast? We've been on it for 10 minutes.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And very nice to have you with us today, as it is every day. And we thank you. Let's see. Anybody want to go more on this? Okay, let's go to another topic. I was pretty sure that was the response I was going to get. I just wanted to check with the group. This was brought to my attention by Bob Bellafiore, and I think it was an excellent observation. We have talked some, but we have not talked a lot about the New York City mayoral race. And as we are just 6 days away from voting is taking place now, but we're 6 days away from actual election day. There are a trio of polls out, some giving Zoran Mamdani, I think, 15 points, 14 points, and others saying that he is about 10 points ahead of Andrew Cuomo. So we look at this race. Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani remains the front runner, and former Governor Andrew Cuomo is trying to catch him while Curtis Sliwa refuses to be forced from the race. More than 220,000 ballots have already been cast, so that's an important thing to keep in mind. Mr. Mamdani, a 34-year-old state lawmaker, remains the clear front runner for City Hall after upsetting Mr. Cuomo in the Democratic primary in June. He summoned the left's biggest stars to a rally Sunday night, drawing thousands of spectators, and is now leaning on an unmatched army of young volunteers to hold his apparent lead. Yet there are signs, if tentative ones, that Mr. Cuomo's relentless third-party comeback attempt may be gaining traction as he seeks to sow doubts about his rival's inexperience and leftist views. More than 223,000 100,000 New Yorkers cast their ballots in those first 3 days of early voting. If that pace holds, some models suggest the city could have its highest turnout in a general election since 1993. The good news, for Mr. Cuomo is that so far Board of Elections data shows that the general electorate is trending markedly older than in the primary. Mr. Mamdani played down any concerns about the early voting data. Any chance of Mr. Cuomo winning, campaign veterans say, would require a surge of older, more moderate New Yorkers. That from the New York Times. You asked for it. You got it. What do you think, Bob?
Well, first, a little bit of context. How big a job being the mayor of New York City is. You know, I'm going to say something off of something you said earlier, Joe, which is, I don't know what this means, you're old or what, but Mamdani has been alive just a little bit longer than you've been on this station.
Yeah.
And I think that's less a reflection of your longevity and more a reflection of his inexperience and lack of preparation for a job like this. Now, what is this job? Do you hear some... Couple of facts, courtesy of my good friend, research policy research expert and general mensch E.J. McMahon Jr. The city's budget.
How's he doing, by the way?
He's doing great.
I haven't seen him in a while.
Yeah,
tell him I said hi. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
He just wrote a great Substack piece about today being the 50th anniversary of Ford to New York Drop Dead, which is great reading and eye opening for people who only read the stories written by people who weren't alive then. Anyway, $116 billion budget. New York's budget is about the size of Florida's. Only three other states, right, California, New York, and Texas, will spend more this year than the city of New York. The population is 8.5 million, is larger than all but about a dozen states. This is how big New York City is. 8.5 million people packed into 300 square miles, which is two-thirds the size of L.A., right? This is the machine. Largest consolidated regional government in America. 325,000 full-time employees, FTEs. Country's largest police department, 33,000 officers. The nation's largest school system, 800,000 kids, $41 billion budget, 130,000 employees, right? The city council has 51 members, right, which is almost the size of the New York State Senate. Each city council member has 165,000 people in their districts. Each city council district is larger than Syracuse. So you are talking about an unfathomably large operation. The mayor, you talk to people in Albany and you say, well, the mayor can't do anything without the state legislature. Not so. The mayor controls the police department, perhaps the single most important agency in New York City. Close behind is the sanitation department picking up garbage. You want to see a revolt in the city, don't pick up garbage. It plays a major role in the school system as long as mayoral control is around and has the ultimate responsibility for everything from cops on the beat, like I said, to potholes. So it is a remarkably huge job. And if you look at the people who have had that job, they haven't all had managerial experience. No one's had managerial experience at a level that large, except maybe Mike Bloomberg, of something that big and that vast. And
there's not many people who have that kind of experience, period. Right.
Right. And you've had people in that job without a ton of, you know, Ed Koch was a congressman, right? Hugh Carey was a congressman and worked in his family business. Rudy Giuliani was a prosecutor. Bill de Blasio was a lifetime political operative. It is a huge decision just for municipal operations on what that job means. But I think what you have in a larger sense is a new face of the Democratic Party. And what you will see, I think you will see, if Mamdani ends up winning on Tuesday, is him being hung around the neck of every Democrat nationally in the same way that Trump has been hung around the neck of every Republican nationally. He will become the new face. He will be on the cover of Time magazine. He will get glowing pieces.
Time magazine? explain that to the younger listeners.
Maybe you should tell the listeners what time. He'll be all over the place, right? And it'll be the ultimate victory.
It's out there. You won't see it, but it's out there.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be a major political challenge, because he will be the face of the way the Democratic Party is going, starting with Bernie in 2016, really taking off with AOC in 2018. She will become the queen bee of the Democratic Party, laying her socialist eggs everywhere. And I think you will see moderate Democrats finding it hard to see where they have a place in this party.
But doesn't regionalism have a part of it? I mean, I think I understand the point. But, you know, it's like saying that if when Joe Manchin won West Virginia, that he's, you know, the new face of the Democratic Party.
It is a much more it's a high profile role like this.
It is a high profile role. Yeah. I'm not saying that, although.
And he said a bunch of things which.
Although I don't know that we've had a mayor in the last year. Right. Like, I don't know what's been going on. With Eric Adams, I just don't know. I understand the point. What I'm saying is I think it's safe. Let me preface this. I think it's, or rephrase it, is what I mean. To say, can Zoran Mamdani win New York City? Maybe. Seems possible, probably.
I think it even seems likely, yeah.
Could he win a statewide election? Probably not.
He got to where he is, where he is like the, I would say, almost prohibitive front runner. I mean, maybe the polls are all wrong, but they, most of them show he has a 10 point lead in a three way race. He got to where he is.
Cuomo's name is on the ballot is somewhere south of Peoria. If you look at the New York City ballot, yeah, there are like eight names before his.
Because he's an independent.
But the New York City's electoral process goes through the Democratic primary, right? It's a dominant Democratic city. You have to win the primary.
Much like the city of Albany.
But the turnout in the primary, although it was higher than usual, was still only a third of the registered Democrats in New York City. And it was, a 12-way race. And so he got...
With ranked choice voting.
He got less than 500,000 votes in the first round. And then because of this complicated system of ranked choice voting, he got a bunch of people who picked up second and third, and that's what gave him the primary. But it was a 12-way race. And he stood out by being sort of young, charismatic, and being very good with social media, and also doing a lot of on-the-ground, door-knocking, right, meeting voters.
One end of the city to the other.
His ideology, which might have been... Like, he shaved the edges off of, like, in the past he had said defund the police, and in the past he had said other things that would have killed his candidacy. In this race, he focused on three or four things that had broad appeal. Freezing the rent, probably the number one thing he says all the time. New York City has rent regulation for about half of its apartments, and he says, as mayor, I'm going to hold the rent flat. He also says he wants to eliminate fares on buses. There's two or three other things he wants to have city-run grocery stores. Do a major tax hike, but only on a tiny fraction of very wealthy people. That message got him the 500,000 votes in the first round, got him the ranked choice victory in a 12-way race. And now he has the advantage of a three-way race because Cuomo, having lost in the Democratic primary, decided to stay in. And
after saying he wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what his exact statements were on that, but he decided to stay in. So now he's between him and Sliwa, they're both making it easier for Mamdani to win. I guess what I'm trying to say is that Mamdani's more extreme positions don't necessarily reflect the mainstream of anything, including New York City. But he played the process very skillfully and is likely to become the next mayor in spite of some extreme views he's taken and in spite of very limited experience.
But don't you think, Judy, that a lot of this has to do who he's running against as well?
He does, and in fact, I mean, Andrew Cuomo's campaign has been criticized from the get-go for being lackadaisical. I mean, he didn't have the energy. He wasn't on all the platforms or all the channels that he should have early on. I mean, his charisma is undeniable. I told the story once before about when I was in Prague, somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, you were from New York. Tell me about Mamdani." And it's like, wow, all over the world, they are aware of this person running for New York City mayor. I'm looking forward to the great discussion of socialism we're going to have once he's elected, because I think there's great confusion among the American public about what it is, how it operates, what is good about it, what is bad about it, how the Trump administration may use it, how what may be happening in New York City. I think if anything good would come out of it, that would be a better education for the average American who has no idea what it is, what communism is, what all that stuff is. They just know it's bad.
I have
and that may be enough.
I have a couple questions. I'd like to ask those. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll do that. We'll get to your questions as well. You can add to the list, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We appreciate you and certainly love hearing from you on the issues. We're talking about this race for mayor in the city of New York. And it has been fascinating to watch. It's in its final days. So what do you make of the two other candidates, Bob?
Curtis Lee was an interesting guy. He's grown a lot. I actually interviewed Curtis Lee in 1983 when he was bringing the Guardian Angels to Albany.
Oh, I did that story, too.
There we go.
Did you do that story? Yeah, I think that was a good story.
I was the Sunday.
It is a good interview.
He was a great interview. I was a Sunday reporter at the RAP, Knickerbocker News, and had to go talk to him in one of the parks in Albany. He's interesting. He's kind of a gadfly, but, he represents a major party line. This notion that he should get out to make up for the, as Judy pointed out, the dog do campaign Cuomo ran in the Democratic primary far be it from Andrew Cuomo, who said Republicans have no place in New York, to go begging Republicans to vote for him for mayor. But that's life in Cuomo land. What do I think of Andrew Cuomo? He didn't really care about this. Andrew Cuomo thinks he's Captain Kirk from the Starship Enterprise, when he's more like Jason from Friday the 13th, right? Captain Kirk thinks he can destroy death, and Jason you can't get rid of. And that's whatever Andrew's got going on in his life. He's like this fight for relevance. And I don't think he ever really wanted to be mayor. It was the next thing that his father lost that he thought he could win.
He, in addition to running a lackadaisical campaign, he had brought all kinds of baggage, right? Like he had resigned.
No one has documented more than you, Bill.
He had resigned from office over multiple scandals that kind of caught up with him in his third term, including most famously allegations of sexual harassment, but also mishandling of COVID in nursing homes. Using public resources to write a memoir that made him $5 million. Like you can go on. The thing is that his governorship was both a disadvantage and an advantage in the race, because first he had huge name recognition. He had continuing loyalty. Some people thought very fondly of his handling of the pandemic. they thought very fondly of what he of his other accomplishments as governor, including rebuilding LaGuardia Airport, which would be important to people in New York City. So it both worked for him and against him. But in the end, it was more negative than positive, because like he was the old guard. He had baggage. He had personality issues. He ran a poor campaign. And this young whippersnapper, you know, ate his lunch.
Here's the thing. You're walking down the supermarket aisle, and you're going to buy a box of cereal. And you see a box of cornflakes that's in an old beat-up box. It's still sealed, but the box, the corner is dinged. You kind of see the cardboard sticking out. But that's your box of cornflakes. And you know what you're going to get with the box of cornflakes. And it's not really attractive because it's old and beaten up, but you know what you're going to get. Next to it is this beautiful box of Lucky Charms. Magically delicious, bright colors, nutritionally empty. Nothing inside. One is old and beaten up, and you think you're going to know what you're going to get, and the other one is new and exciting, and you're buying that new box. And that's what Mamdani is. Mamdani is a fresh, clean box of Lucky Charms with nothing inside.
So, Bob, do you think Cuomo would be a better mayor than Curtis Lewa or Mamdani?
No, I have no idea what kind of mayor Mamdani will be. I think he's in for a rude awakening of how much grunty work it is. What do I think about Andrew being mayor? I don't think Andrew will be a good mayor.
Is he the cornflakes in your metaphor?
He's closer to the cornflakes, but he's in the old beaten-up box, and you know what you're going to get. What are you going to get with Andrew? Somebody who blows with the wind, right? Is this the Andrew Cuomo who campaigned for and signed bail reform? Or is this the Andrew who thinks bail reform went too far? Is he right? So which one are you going to get? The thing about Andrew is he's whatever he has to be at any given moment. He has no, I mean, Mamdani at least, and Sliwa have a core of something they believe in. Andrew believes in Andrew. And that's it. And he'll do whatever he has to do to help satisfy whatever needs he has.
All right, so I want to get to some letters because people are ticked off at you, Bob. So let me get to those.
Poor Bob. Be nice to Bob.
You know what? I'm feeling uncomfortable now.
I'm feeling
like this isn't a safe space for me.
It was the AOC weighing socialist eggs.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. Disgraceful comment by that measure. Can we label Trump as laying pedophile eggs, grifter eggs, laying eggs?
Yeah, sure.
As for the mayor's race, by claiming the job's enormity, can we use that same brush on Hegseth, a TV pundit, Gabbard, no experience, RFK Jr., a heroin addict with a brain worm? Mamdani has enough experience. We'll be able to have plenty of staff and will be 100 times better than Handy Andy. Give me a break, says David. Then we go to this note with the tagline, racist and sexist comment. Regarding the comment that AOC will be the queen bee laying her socialist eggs everywhere, lest the extreme racism and sexism of this comment go unnoticed. You have reduced a woman of color who is a leader forward in contemporary politics to an inhuman and unthinking breeder of danger. How dare you? On the basis of privilege, that's how. That's from Danny. Donnie, D-A-N-N-I, my apologies. Then we go to this letter. This will be the last one that I'll...
This is great. No.
Oh, okay. Jen says, has Bob been absent the past 7 years? Ever since AOC won her seat, she has been used as a tool by the Republicans who cried that the country will turn socialist no matter who wins the New York City mayoral race. The Republicans will use the same playbook in the midterms as they have for the past 8 years. If you want to talk about the election, please spend some time, that was spelled out in shiny caps, that's why I gave it that emphasis, spend some time talking about the proposal on the ballot, which most don't know about or don't understand.
Can I say I just totally agree with all three of those letters? The right has demonized AOC ever since she came on the scene. And she is a dynamic force. And I think that old white men are threatened by her. And it's as simple as that.
Here's the AOC is an important force. I will give you that. Here's why this Mamdani election as we expect will happen, is such a bellwether event. A nickel for anybody who remembers who AOC beat to get into Congress. She beat a guy named Joel Crowley.
I could have come up with that.
She beat a guy named
could have been a nickel richer.
She beat a guy named Joel Crowley, who's from a political family, who had been an assembly member from Queens and then ran to Congress
in
Queens.
He was the chair of the Queens Democratic Party.
Chair of the Queens Democratic Party and very close to Nancy Pelosi and in the leadership track in the House, right? He forgot his district and lost in a primary to AOC in 2018, right? And since then, every moderate Democrat in New York, some in this very region, in this listening area, are petrified of being Crowleyed, of forgetting where their district is and being hit by somebody who comes out of nowhere and outworks them and kicks them out of their comfortable office. Mamdani is the World Series of that. Well, no, it's the championship series of that. It's the next level up in the playoffs. Presidency would be the ultimate one. And Mamdani a year ago was nobody. He was a three-term assembly member, 33 years old, had never passed a bill. Nobody knew anything about him. He came out of nowhere to knock off, you know, a scion of the Democratic Party.
Scott Stringer, Brad Lander.
Cleaned out all the old guys. He cleaned out all the old guys. Now, the one that sends a message to is Governor Hochul. Because if there's, you think politicians hate general elections, they'd much rather run unopposed. They are petrified, and Democrats in New York are petrified of primaries, especially from the extreme left. So Mamdani winning this and beating Cuomo now twice, right? After being outspent, name recognition, list of things he can point to, sends a message to every moderate Democrat that you got to watch out for your left flank. The state legislature, Bill, you know this as well as anybody, is more aligned with Mamdani than, you know, moderate Democrats. So there will be enormous pressure on the governor to act in the next 6 months to avoid getting hit from the left in a thing that she doesn't see coming. And that's where he's going to have the biggest impact. I mean, yeah, he's got to pick up the garbage and make sure the fire department runs well and all that sort of stuff. That's on the ground. But politically?
Well, so you said before that you listed all the important jobs that the mayor has, the police, the fire, the sanitation, that kind of stuff. But the campaign wasn't about those things.
Never is.
And those things, they were, you know, it was about free buses and freezing the rent. Those things are going to catch up to Mamdani in completely unpredictable ways. Some crisis is going to happen. It could be a natural disaster. It could be something the police does. It could be something, something that bubbles up in the schools. It could be corruption. And how he handles those things, because he's an executive now. He's not a legislator. He's not an attorney general. He can't call the shots. He is the victim of events, or you know,
subject to events. He's not.
And so he has this reputation, and he's throwing a scare into moderates by having won. But if he runs a disastrous mayoralty, that gets neutralized. Suddenly, the moderates look like the smart ones. And so I think we all, like, I think his odds of doing well as mayor are pretty poor because of his lack of experience and his youth. That's me as an old guy, you know, like I think age brings wisdom. I'm biased about that. But he has a chance of doing well. And if he brings in smart people who are to his right, I think he needs a spectrum of people on his team, and he also needs people who know the stuff, that know the police department, the fire department, the sanitation department. So I guess we'll see. I thought, like, AOC came in like a wrecking ball,
yeah,
to use a metaphor,
Just don't make hold on, is that a sexist metaphor?
She's grown into the role. She's diffused some of the people who hated her. But she's still quite young and inexperienced, and she is a legislator. She's not an executive, so she's not as subject to events as the mayor will be.
Yeah, Bill.
I'm watching. We got to go to the news break. We're very late, and rightfully so.
Yeah, we are.
They get fussy and want to do it on time, and that's what we should do. So we're going to go over and do that. We'll be back. We have plenty of time to talk. We'll discuss this a little bit more, and we'll move on to other subjects. We'll be right back. I realize this may be a tangent, but when I was a kid, I used to watch a lot of game shows. And one of the game shows I watched was Family Feud. And Family Feud was hosted by Richard Dawson. And they would have the fast money round. And there would be two family members, and they would go for the $5,000, and they would ask five questions to the one family, or one family member, and then they'd ask five questions to the other family member. And while the one was asking, they would send the other one off stage and put into a booth wearing headphones, and they could hear nothing. And I remember, even as a very cynical young person, thinking to myself, because they couldn't hear the answers mm-hmm. of what their family member is saying, and I remember as a cynical youth saying, "Oh, come on, they can certainly hear. How can you do that?" And while you all were arguing, I just put my headphones on. I couldn't hear a thing.
Argument
so
canceled.
I
headphones.
Don't know. I don't know what you were all going on about. But I, because I'm hoping you will then force that energy back into the show.
I will inject some of the substance, but without maybe the energy. And I just want to respond. I just want to respond.
Yeah, God knows we don't want energy on the show.
I just want to respond to the writer who called my comments about AOC sexist and racist.
Well, there's a few, but go ahead.
Yeah, to the whole district in the Berkshires and the Capital Region who said that stuff. I just want to say that the labeling is one of the fundamental problems that inhibits any kind of legitimate discussion about policy issues, right? If somebody says, "I don't think this should be that," and it involves a certain population, the first arrow out of the quiver is the IST, is the label, and that makes it impossible to have a conversation about substance. If somebody wants to say that, so I'll just something that came up in the last week, that Mamdani was talking about 9/11 and the example he used about the impact of 9/11 was his aunt, his father's cousin, who did not feel comfortable on the subway wearing a hijab. And his response, and people criticized that, and he said, that's Islamophobia. So when you go to ism, phobia, you automatically labeling a person instead of having a conversation about the substance of the issue. And until we get over this notion of labeling people with a derogatory term that they then have to defend, as I just tried to do for 10 minutes on the break with Judy, then you are inhibiting any ability to have a conversation and find solutions. And that's why the great center on the left and right are getting less and less of a place in public discourse. And the extremes that you see on MSNBC and Fox News are dominating the conversation.
But what if it's true?
Well, tell me why it's sexist and racist. To say your comment.
Well, Judy told you why it was sexist and racist.
And talked about all other people instead of me.
I guess I don't see any hint of racism in what Bob said, and I also didn't feel like it was sexist. The analogy was to a queen bee, and I think it's an idea, you know, a queen bee. I mean, apparently queen bees don't actually work the way Bob suggested, but
I never suggested they work. I say they lay eggs, and they're the reason the hive exists.
I think his point, if I understood it, was that she was influential in the formation, in like the policy making debate of the Democratic Party. which I think is true.
And in the political like, dynamics
that's,
in the Democratic
I think
Party.
That's the thing that, like, his use of a colorful metaphor shouldn't distract from the substance of what he was saying, which is undeniably true, that she is influential in the debate of the Democratic Party.
You know, last
disproportionately
night,
so, I would say.
Bill Hammond.
Last night I was working on the stories, and I thought to myself, well, Bob's right. We haven't talked about the election in a long time. We should talk about the election in a long time. And now I'm reminded of why we haven't talked about the election in a long time.
It is juicy election.
It is. It's a really interesting election. It's absolutely, and I find myself fascinated by it in its many forms. I obviously, like I think everyone in this room, can vote in the city of New York. But I was there watching those debates. I'm fascinated by it.
I will say it is the most consequential municipal election that we have seen maybe ever in this country because of the place where it's occurring, the timing of it heading right into the midterms next year, where these sort of divisive labeling things are, you know, all on display. And because of the impact it has on, including the New York governor's election, and the impact it actually has on the lives of 8.5 million people who live in New York City, and the millions more who go back and forth in there for work.
Okay, some more letters, and then we'll move on to another topic, I promise. Christopher, pretty much each week, the panel laments the disadvantages Democrats face due to the ways they have been hampered by Republicans' maneuvering of the systems of government and media strategies. To therefore argue it's a bad thing Mondami is likely to be elected by the ways he played the process is beyond satire. I, for one, welcome the rise of a new box of cereal who opposes the unfettered rise of the ultra-rich, the current genocide in Gaza, even if some of his policies are likely unable to be implemented in full. Then we go to Pamela.
Is that my brother again?
Yes. Pamela, thanks, Bob. Your defects list for the leading mayoral candidate in New York City has convinced me even more that he is well qualified for the job. I wish I could vote for him. Then we go to Lee. Look, the Democrats are lost, rudderless. They need juice, energy. Americans want change. That's what Bernie represented, and he polled better against Trump in the two-way rather than Hillary when he was running. Again, Americans want change, and that is what Mondami wants. Then we go to this. Lucky Charms, Paul Leaves. Zoran has an agenda, and it's for the people. Simple as that. Go with the people. All right. Then we go to another note from Adam. Thanks for the lesson on the existence of New York City and that it is a large, complex, and densely populated place. I never would have known. Yes, that is sarcasm. Democrats have gone less than nowhere with centrism. They don't win elections, but if they do, they accomplish little. I want more socialism in government and for the Democrats to stop setting their clocks to the right. I can't wait for the metaphorical extinction of dinosaurs like Andrew Cuomo. Then we go to this, Brendan says, please tell Bob that people with different views will gladly have a civil debate. However, when someone in that debate uses offensive metaphors, then that person is lowering the civility of the discussion. In that case, it is fair to call out such language because it impedes the content of the discussion. Which brings us to Melissa's note that says, would Bob have used the queen bee metaphor if he was talking about a man? Then we go to this note from Liz. Being a progressive person myself, I view Mondami's popularity in the light of New York City's voters being sick and tired of political corruption and economic inequality. I suggest that Trump and MAGA helped create Mondami's stature. MAGA is more radical than Mondami's policies, in my opinion. And
you know, the discussion we were having a
moment
ago.
We have a lot of letters. I'm just trying to rein them in here, but go ahead.
Well, the Bob's point about labeling people with ists and isms, that actually turned out to be a big part of this particular campaign. We didn't talk about it before, but there was part of Cuomo's argument was that that Mamdani represented a vein of anti-Semitism. He didn't exactly call Mamdani himself anti-Semitic. He kind of implied it. But he said that, you know, Mamdani comes from the point of view that what's going on in Gaza has been a genocide, and he's very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. It's actually how he got into politics in the first place. And so Cuomo tried to leverage that to get support among Jewish New Yorkers. And there were – so there were a lot of talk about anti-Semitism. And that – and there was some response from Mamdani about Islamophobia. So both those two words came up in this race, and they may have been decisive for some blocks of voters. And like that, it's a part of our politics, for better or for worse. I mean, I guess I'm in the school of thought that thinks it's for worse. It was a big part of this race, and it's probably going to be, as I think someone just said, a big part of the midterms and the presidential coming up.
All right. Let's move on. There are other letters, but they all are very similar, so we'll move on. I think those points have been made. We go to breaking the impasse, and the impasse we're talking about, of course, is the shutdown. There is a news analysis piece in the New York Times of what can break the shutdown impasse. Senate Republicans were confident that the call on Monday from the largest federal employees union for an end to the government shutdown would finally nudge labor-allied Senate Democrats to move toward resolving the stalemate entering its fifth week. Democrats were instead mostly unmoved. Their bet was that news on Wednesday of soaring health care premiums because of expiring Obamacare tax credits, which we'll talk about in a little bit, might finally persuade Republicans to negotiate on extending the subsidies. That didn't pan out either. GOP leaders have so far refused, at least until the government reopens. So now the question is, what, if anything, can break the impasse that has led to federal workers being idled and force the warring parties to a solution? Bill Hammond.
I'll tell you the thing, just as a ordinary person living in the world, the thing that I'm worried about is like how much longer planes can fly with the air traffic controllers not getting paid. We're coming up on the busiest travel season mm-hmm. of the year, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and if the air traffic controllers still aren't getting paid when we come to Thanksgiving and Christmas, it just feels like that could be. There could be some bad things that happen. I mean, you know, just the normal tie-ups around Thanksgiving, some of them are going to be attributed to the shutdown. So, I mean, that's something I've been thinking about. But, you know, there are other things that could crop up. I mean, the one issue that Democrats have tried to raise is that SNAP benefits are apparently going to get cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, so that means people literally – in some cases, going without food or having to go to a food pantry instead of using their SNAP benefits. So those are all things that are going to sharpen the pressure on the politicians. But the thing is, both parties think this is working to their advantage. And I think the polling, like, I don't think the polling is like coming down. I haven't actually looked at this recently, but the polls I saw earlier sort of gave both parties equal levels of blame. And until one party views it as being more painful to it than the other, it seems like this deadlock can continue indefinitely.
Which, again, just shows the deep divisions within the country once again. Bob.
Yeah, this is like two people sitting across the table with electrodes attached to their fingers. And somebody keeps, you know, turning the dial to see how much how much of a shock they can withstand. I think up until I think the Democrat strategy has been, let's wait till November comes. As things go on, the pain will be inflicted more on the Republicans exponentially once we get into these critical dates. The Democrats have tried on the Obamacare subsidies. My question would be, why did they make them temporary in the first place? I mean, it was only Democrats who voted for these temporary subsidies. So
it's the same reason all of the tax cuts are temporary.
But
it has to do with gaming the CBO.
By letting them expire, the Republicans, I'd say, would be following the law as the Democrats wrote it.
Yeah.
The SNAP thing is serious, and I would not be surprised if by midnight tomorrow the Trump administration finds $9 billion sitting between two sofa cushions to fund SNAP. Because if SNAP isn't funded, that's one of those things that can turn this debate against them. I think overall the country is probably fine with not making new law that extends government funded health care to illegal immigrants. I think the country is probably fine without the additions that the Democrats want. But if the Trump administration is going to start leaving poor kids hungry, That's I think, is a major turn in the conversation and flips the leverage to the Democrats. So that's why I think they'll find $9 billion under a sofa cushion by tomorrow night.
Yeah, I think I agree with Bill. I think the polling's been pretty even. But I'm a little annoyed with the media, the news media, because they always frame it as, well, who's being blamed? It's like the blame game. It's like, well, that's the important thing, is who Americans blame for the shutdown. I think a better question to ask Americans is, are they really concerned? Do they really care? And I'm thinking that a lot of this still has not hit most Americans in any measurable way. As someone who has a trip planned in December, I too am worried about whether or not the planes will fly safely. So I don't like this blame game, and my overall reaction to this is it makes me just not like politicians even more. It's just like everything out of everybody's mouth is like, we're calling it the Schumer shutdown now, or we're calling it the Republicans are taking money away from poor people. I don't like those kinds of framing anyway. I just want I think the only way through this is a compromise, and it sounds like in the back channels, we're seeing some efforts to come up with some sort of temporary compromise, which, again, just temporarily solves the problem. I think maybe next week's elections may nudge the discussion one way or the other. If the Democrats do really well, if the Democrats don't do so well, that could have play a role in what's happening. I am worried about the elimination of the SNAP benefits. It's people. I think I see out there on social media people rising, churches, nonprofit groups coming to the table and saying, we're going to help our neighbors who can't afford their food this week. I don't think that's going to do enough, but I think it's a good measure of why people care about feeding the poor. Again, I still don't think that the majority of Americans are paying attention to that.
No, they'll pay attention when the pain hits them. Which is always the case. Like, people aren't going to care if it's theoretical pain in some policy world. They'll figure the people in charge will figure it out. But when it comes home, that right, what's the old thing about a recession is when your friend loses your job, but a depression is when you lose your job. Right? And it's kind of the same thing.
Anybody else on that? Nobody has anything to say that could fill 43 seconds?
No.
Okay.
I'm sure you got another Christmas card for me to read.
I never run out of those, Bob. No, you're absolutely right. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have other items to discuss, and we will do that. Yeah, go ahead.
Here's one of the things on the SNAP issue. I mean, Judy, you're right. Churches, nonprofits are coming through, but I sit on the Board of Catholic Charities in the Capital Region, and we were having this conversation yesterday, and we have 14 food pantries, and they can help people for a week at a time, but now they're looking at a month worth of food at a time, and you just don't have it. I mean, a lot of these things are funding regional food. There's a whole network, regional food banks. They get the food deliveries. you know, these federal programs help pay for that. And that is it brought our CEO to tears at our board meeting yesterday about the impact this will be. And that's what got me thinking, okay, this is a real serious thing. So if the Trump administration has a single piece of gray matter in it, and some people in this listening area may not think they do, politically and substantively, they'll find the $9 billion and fund just this one thing and say, oh, it's a discretionary thing. It doesn't change any of the issues. We're not making new law. It doesn't change the continuing resolution that we're trying to do. We're just funding this one stopgap thing.
Exactly 42 seconds. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll finish up before this morning. We have more topics to get to, and we welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Judy Patrick, Bill Hammond, and Bob Bellafiore making up the group this morning. And again, we do welcome your thoughts as well. Last chance on the letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bob Bellafiore, Bill Hammond, and Judy Patrick with us on this morning's broadcast. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I mentioned that we would discuss one of the aspects of the last story. Well, I guess it was the Fed story of having to do with waiting to see, it was about the impasse of waiting to see what impact there would be when it was announced what Obamacare prices would be. And those have now become public, highlighting big increases. The Trump administration has released a preview of the available plan sold through Obamacare marketplaces in 30 states, giving Americans who buy their own health insurance a first look at just how much prices would go up. This from the New York Times, Reed Abelson and Margot Sanger-Katz. Insurers have increased rates significantly for next year, an average of about 30% for a typical plan in the 30 states where the federal government manages markets, and an average of 17% in states that run their own markets, according to a new analysis from KFF, the health research group. But the biggest impact for nearly all Americans covered by Obamacare plans will occur with the expiration of generous subsidies at the end of the year unless Congress extends them. Prices on the government's website, healthcare.gov, reflect that change using calculations based on a return to the lower subsidy levels offered before 2021. The extra funding helped to make insurance effectively free for poorer Americans and offered financial help for the first time for people earning more than four times the federal poverty level, or about $64,000 for a single person. If the funding expires, costs will go up for more than 20 million Americans who currently buy their own insurance in the marketplace established under the Affordable Care Act. Judy.
Health insurance is going up for everybody, not just the people on Obamacare, every year it goes up. It doesn't ever go down, but it's going up significantly, and this affects small businesses. Anybody who runs a business who provides health insurance for their employees, it may influence some people to decide not to have any insurance offerings to their people as well. I mean, I know there are people in my life who don't have insurance. Even now with the Obamacare subsidies, it's just too expensive. And we were talking off air about turning to Bill, who is kind of an expert on health insurance. You know, why is the cost of medical care so expensive, and why is our insurance so expensive?
So
solve that for us, will you?
Yeah. Explain that.
Sure. By the way, and try to overcome the derogatory notion of you as an expert.
Yeah, yeah.
As Moynihan said, right? Oh, there you go with the slurs again.
What I've come to believe is that the fundamental reason healthcare keeps getting more expensive, in addition to sort of the good reasons, which are you know, we're getting older. Good reason meaning a valid reason. We're getting older, so we need more health care. But also medicine is developing new technologies and treatments. Those tend to be more expensive. But beyond all of that, we also have a fundamental problem in this country of not being willing to say no to the healthcare system. When the healthcare system asks for money, we generally write the check no matter how much it is. And when I say we, I'm not talking about actual individual consumers. In our system, it's mostly the government and the employers who are making those decisions. The government has healthcare is an entitlement. The two big programs, Medicaid and Medicare, they're some of the biggest, most expensive things the government does. And they are on entitlements, so they're not affected by the shutdown. The money just keeps flowing. And employers, they have mixed feelings about all this because they kind of resent how expensive it is, and they're the ones writing the checks, even though it's in effect coming out of our compensation. But they also feel a responsibility to take care of their workers, and they also don't want to say no. If one of their workers gets seriously ill, they don't want to be in a position of telling their sick employee which hospital they can't go to. So they're reluctant to tighten the screws on their health insurance. And the net effect of all of this is that healthcare costs exceed inflation, vastly exceed inflation on a regular basis year after year after year. And that trickles down into our health premiums.
So that's on the paying side. But what's driving the cost increases? Right, we've heard for years, right? Doctors overprescribe tests because they practice defensive medicine because they're afraid of malpractice.
There's some of that,
right? Right. Pharmaceutical companies spend billions of dollars to develop a new cure, so there are costs built into that, so they can recoup their R&D costs.
We also have, like, we pay our healthcare workers more than they do in other countries. So, like, our doctors and our nurses and other people who work in the healthcare system make better salaries because of the phenomenon I just described. Like, the healthcare system is very well organized politically, and they have a very effective message, which is, if you don't give us enough money, people will die. And that message resonates, and few politicians are willing to say no under those circumstances.
And then there's the other dynamic. If you don't give us enough money, you will die. We will get you, because they're politically organized. You know, $11.99.
Your career will die.
We will find someone to replace you who will help us. So you better get along.
But getting back to the particular issue, the enhanced subsidies, a couple points should be made. The article closed by saying it affects 20 million people. It's about 6% of the U.S. population. But it varies a lot from state to state. In Florida, it's almost 20% of the population is on Obamacare, which shocks me. In New York, it's 0.6% of the population is affected by these enhanced subsidies, because we have the essential plan, and most of the people who would otherwise be getting those subsidies are in the essential plan. So it's for the people who are affected, it's a big deal. Their insurance bill, depending on what their income is, their insurance bill could go up by thousands of dollars a year. But it's not that many people who are facing that problem in New York.
Is there a red state, blue state divide on that distribution of people?
Yes. The red states, by and large, have larger populations benefiting from Obamacare, ironically, because they didn't expand Medicaid, and therefore there's more people who are in the position of needing to buy insurance on their own through the exchanges.
Right, because that's an interesting pressure point, because the whole subsidies were approved only by Democrats in Congress, and then in 21, they were enhanced with a 21 or 22 with and set to expire this year. So interestingly, it was a Democratic extension of this of an enhancement of this subsidy.
Well, and it was based on the Affordable Care Act, which was passed with, I think, zero Republican
votes.
So this whole infrastructure is was created by Democratic votes. The enhancements were passed during the pandemic. They were meant to be temporary, or at least they were written to be temporary. They're now expiring. They're not literally on the table in the continuing resolution, except to the extent that the Democrats have said they want them on the table. This thing is expiring. We think you should deal with it as part of this continuing resolution. And that's one of the real sticking points, is the Republicans are saying we can talk about potentially extending those credits, but we don't think it should be part of the continuing resolution. Right, that's really the dispute.
Which is kind of funny. The other conversation, this is analogous to saying Andrew Cuomo asking Republican Curtis Lee would to drop out, for Curtis Lee would to save Andrew Cuomo from his incompetent campaign. And these are Democrats who approved these things with an expiration date, begging the Republicans to save them from the bill they passed.
But it's not saving them. It's saving, 20 million Americans, many of whom live in red states. So, I mean, I think that was actually politically speaking, I think it was a clever choice of the Democrats. When this whole fight over the continuing resolution first came up, the thing they put on the table was, we want you to reverse every last piece of health care cut in the One Big Beautiful Bill. I'm talking about $1 trillion over 10 years. That seemed like a very big ask. I think I even said that on this show. But extending the subsidies, first of all, is not as much money. It's an immediate issue. It's taking effect right now. It takes effect on January 1st, but the shopping process starts on Sunday. And it happens to affect red states more than blue states. So, I think that they landed on an effective talking point for this purpose in Congress, the Democrats.
2 minutes. A lot of letters. Here we go. Ross, healthcare costs are so expensive for two reasons. We have a for-profit healthcare system. Insurance providers, number two, are traded on the public market and therefore must show a profit for their investors. Retirement accounts are robustly supported by health insurance providers. This country will never see their way forward regarding healthcare because too much profit is involved in investors and pensioners. You were...
The cost of health insurance, meaning the administrative cost, including the profit, is something like 5% of healthcare expenses. It's steady over time. That's not why healthcare costs are growing. And in fact, part of that money, that 5% of spending, is spent on trying to control fraud and waste. So if you took that away, fraud and waste would arguably get worse. So I really, and another thing to think about is that a lot of the providers in the healthcare system are effectively operating on a for-profit basis. I mean, the traditional model of a doctor hanging out a shingle is in a partnership, that's a for-profit business. So, there's profit motive all over the place. Nonprofit operators have a profit motive. I think that's a fundamentally inaccurate understanding and analysis of why our healthcare system is so expensive.
Bill Hammond gets the last word on this edition of the Roundtable. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Judy Patrick. Thanks to Bob Bellafiore. A pleasure to have you all here. Thank you very much for sharing with us. We'll be back right after this.